Hello and welcome to Advocate, a podcast channel by ASEAN Parliamentarians for Human Rights, or APHR. On this channel, we're delving into some of the most important human rights and democracy issues affecting Southeast Asia. And if you like what you hear, please check out our two earlier series, Parliamentarians at Risk and ASEAN's Rakhine Crisis. My name is Oliver Slow, and I'm APHR's Media and Communications Officer. Welcome to our five-part series, Myanmar, Anatomy of a Coup, and our final episode, Looking Ahead. This series takes a close look at the major players in Myanmar's current context. Speaking with a broad range of people, both inside and outside the country, we aim to better understand these actors' mindsets, interests, and motivations, with a view to identifying measures that the international community, including those here in Southeast Asia and further afield, can take to put an end to the military's chaotic and violent rule and ensure that democracy and the will of the people prevail. In earlier episodes, we've looked at the major actors both inside and outside of Myanmar with regards to the coup that took place there on the 1st of February. This includes the Myanmar military themselves, the Tatmadaw, as well as those resisting the coup, such as activists, politicians, journalists, and members of the civil disobedience movement. We've also looked at Myanmar's international relations with countries such as China, Japan, the United States, the United Kingdom, Australia, and of course, ASEAN. Throughout all of this, we've had one eye on this final episode, which aims to use much of what we've discussed in those first four episodes to provide solid recommendations to international actors, including governments, but also humanitarian actors, think tanks, and anyone with an interest in Myanmar, about what measures can be taken to support the brave efforts being made by the people on the ground and help bring an end to the military's violent rule. From a moral perspective at least, things couldn't be much clearer in terms of standing on the side of democracy and human rights. After all, not only has the Tatmadaw stolen an election, if not completely free and fair, honestly reflected the true will of the people, they've also resorted to despicable violence to try and quell, so far unsuccessfully, a popular uprising against its rule. Yet sadly, there are no easy solutions. The Tatmadaw has advanced weaponry, funds, and even powerful friends at its disposal. And as much as we wish it wasn't the case, we also have to take into account real politics. The recommendations we offer throughout this episode are based on our knowledge of the situation, coupled with hours and hours of discussions and interviews with a whole range of actors, both inside and outside the country. We firmly believe they're the most realistic that can be taken to help bring an end to the chaos on the ground and ultimately see an end to the military's rule. The Tatmadaw may claim it is the sole protector of the nation, but the reality is that it's the single biggest factor in holding the country back from further progress in the last few decades in terms of political freedoms, the economy, education, and many more areas. Thank you to all those who interviewed for this series and for all of the listeners who have followed along. We'd be incredibly grateful if you could share this widely with your friends, professional networks, or on social media, and also leave reviews wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks again.
They don't want to go back to past history that we have already experienced, where we face different types of violations, which is now happening again. People don't really go back to the same past experience of all the people fighting against the military and dictatorship.
I would like to send a message to international community from ASEAN communities especially. This is not an internal affair. This is failing the democracy in Myanmar is also failing the democracy in your country. Then you have to remember that. If you are the good neighbors for Myanmar, please help Myanmar.
Early May marked 100 days since the military launched its coup in Myanmar. Since then, drastic developments have occurred on an almost daily basis, and at times it's been difficult to keep up, but here are a few of the basic facts. More than 800 dead. That figure includes children as young as 6, as well as teenagers peacefully protesting on the streets, and officials from the National League for Democracy, whose families have had their bodies returned to them with what appear to be clear signs of torture. There have also been thousands arrested. As we speak, there are currently more than 4,000 people detained in prisons across the country, including lawmakers, journalists, activists, and civil servants. The junta has also launched airstrikes and conducted mortar shelling in civilian areas amid its fighting with ethnic armed groups. And yet, despite the brutal measures of the junta, the people have risen up. We heard from many of those resisting the coup in episode 3 of this series, including human rights defenders, reporters, and members of the civil disobedience movement. We also heard from members of the National Unity Government, formed by activists and MPs-elect, which is aiming to gain international legitimacy as the recognised government of Myanmar. In this, the final episode of the series, we'll hear from a range of people, both inside and outside of Myanmar, as well as adding some of our own analysis about what action members in the international community can take to support those brave efforts taking place on the ground and ultimately ensure that the military's rule is brought to an end. We will admit up front we don't think this is necessarily going to be an easy process or even a quick one. It will require a range of different measures taken by a range of different actors, probably over a long period of time. It will require determination, resilience, and cooperation from those involved. But we sincerely believe that those efforts combined, coupled with those being taken by people inside Myanmar, could result in the military being forced into a retreat, and democracy and the will of the people ultimately prevailing. Since February the 1st, Myanmar activists have time and again called for international support in their efforts to overthrow the military. Here's Thin Zaw Shun Le Yi, a prominent human rights defender.
So the international community has been kind of helping Myanmar since a long time ago. Even when Aung San Suu Kyi was detained, the international communities, they are there to support Aung San Suu Kyi in any way they can. So I really appreciate all our friends around the whole country, including human rights organizations, the peoples from different countries. They've been there. And now it's again, help us again.
So what can that help look like? First of all, it's important to recognize that the international community is essentially acting as a support mechanism for the resistance movement inside Myanmar. Here's Richard Horsey, a longtime Myanmar observer, and who we heard from a few times throughout this series.
We have to be realistic and recognize that what happens in Myanmar, where this situation goes next, depends primarily on what happens within Myanmar. It depends on the protest movement, on the civil disobedience movement, depends on the enormous public outrage that the coup has triggered, and then the enormous outrage that the violence against peaceful demonstrators has triggered. That's where this story is being written, not in the hallways of international diplomacy. But that doesn't mean that the world can do nothing. I mean, the first thing is that the outside world needs to show solidarity with the people of the country. I think it's also important that the outside world stands with the people of Myanmar, not just in word, but as much as possible in solidarity.
It's a viewpoint echoed by Chris Sadotti, who is part of the UN fact-finding mission on Myanmar and is now a member of the Special Advisory Council for Myanmar.
We outsiders can seek to do only two things. First, we can support and encourage the people of Myanmar as they struggle to determine their future. The second thing we outsiders can do is to place as much pressure as possible on the military leadership to stop their repression, to stop the murders, to stop the arrests, to stop the corruption and the economic impoverishment of the people of Myanmar for the enrichment of the generals and the military.
In the last few months, people in Myanmar have called for the United Nations to invoke the principle of responsibility to protect, better known as R2P. Up and down the country, there have been chants, placards, and candlelit vigils with one simple demand: we need R2P. Similar calls were made by the Rohingya following the military's atrocious campaign against them in 2016 and 2017. But what is R2P? Well, R2P was adopted by the United Nations in 2005, introduced in response to the failure of the international community to respond effectively to the mass atrocities in Rwanda and Srebrenica in the 1990s. It has three pillars. The first is that every state has a responsibility to protect its populations from four mass atrocity crimes, namely genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity, and ethnic cleansing. The second pillar is that the international community has, quote, the responsibility to encourage and assist individual states in meeting that responsibility. Finally, if a state is, quote, manifestly failing to protect its populations, the international community must be prepared to take appropriate collective action in a timely and decisive manner and in accordance with the UN Charter. Contrary to what some believe, however, it's not primarily about military intervention. Other measures include naming, shaming, and diplomatic isolation, arms embargoes, targeted sanctions, as well as international judicial action. We'll discuss a few of these in the context of Myanmar throughout this episode. In all reality, an armed intervention into Myanmar is unlikely. Firstly, it would never be agreed to by the UN Security Council due to China and Russia's vetoes, while no country with serious military capability in the region or elsewhere has shown any willingness to take up arms against the Myanmar military, with or without Security Council approval. Here's Chris Sidoti again.
Certainly the situation in Myanmar rightly leads to calls for the responsibility to protect being invoked. It can take a wide variety of forms, and certainly it should take the form of applying as much pressure as possible on the military to prevent the violation of human rights, these kinds of atrocities as we're seeing. I would, however, caution against talking about foreign military intervention, because that works well only where it occurs with the agreement of the state. It can play an important role, but I would fear that the Tatmadaw would never agree to it, and that means that we may well have war in Myanmar, like we have had in Afghanistan and Iraq and elsewhere, when foreign military intervention has been attempted in the face of the opposition of a local armed force. I'm not sure that that's what the people of Myanmar want. I suspect it's not. But that's not the only option. There are other options for pressuring the generals. Regrettably, they take determination. And to date, the United Nations has not shown sufficient determination. They take commitment and they take time. Time is not on the side of the people of Myanmar at the moment when these atrocities are being committed. But I regret to say that the international community is not going to be able to provide a very quick solution. The future lies first and foremost in the hands of the people themselves, and it's our job to support them.
So short of military intervention, what measures can the international community take to help the people of Myanmar? Well, the most pressing priority is to end the violence. As we mentioned at the start of this episode, more than 800 people have been killed since the coup, with that figure rising on an almost daily basis. In the last few days and weeks, we've seen a rise in violence in Mindat in Chin State in the country's west, as well as in Kayah State in the east, after groups opposed to the junta fought back against them. Just a few days ago, at least 4 people were killed when the military reportedly launched an attack on a church sheltering displaced people in Luikor, the Kayah State capital. Here's the view of Kin Omar, a long-term human rights defender.
The first and foremost important thing is to end these military atrocities, the hunters atrocities, these deliberate attacks on the unarmed civilians. You know, like whether they are marching on the streets or staying in their house, whether they are 20 years old or 50 years old or 7 years old. You know, like people, what we need first and foremost right now as we speak is the security. There is lack of human security across the country at the moment because this military is a ruthless, murderous, barbarian, savage military that, you know, I don't think we can even call them military. These are the savage murderers. We need the security for the people first. What we need is the international community to actually do that first. Who can do that? Of course, clearly, that's the Security Council. The Security Council need to send a delegation, at least led by the Secretary General, to knock the door and go in to stop the violence, monitor and intervene. And what do we mean by intervene? I think what we mean by intervene is the people on the ground are clearly calling for their responsibility to protect the RTP because they want the protection and they think this is the only way their lives can be saved from this murderous regime. I think, like, you know, whether it is RTP or not, to me, it's not about the debate of the RTP concept. It's about saving our people's lives on the ground. I think we need that ASAP. It cannot be delayed anymore because, you know, the massacres are happening. People cannot even sleep at night anymore. There is a massive destruction of properties, you know, like lootings, extortion of money, burning the people's alive, you know, and using these lethal weapons such as like machine guns and like RPG, and they are now bombing in the ethnic Karen areas. This is the crimes against humanity and war crimes. So why is this that the world keeps watching?
Although it has issued a few statements, the UN Security Council has largely gone missing throughout this crisis, mainly as a result of the vetoes held by China and Russia, but also because of reluctance of other member states to push through a resolution on Myanmar, because they know it would be vetoed. Here's Janelle Safin, the Australian MP we heard from in the previous episode.
It would be important for all parties to push a resolution in the Security Council, because, you know, and as everyone says, oh, China and Russia will veto it. Well, let them veto it and let them explain why.
So if not the Security Council, one of the other key actors who could help in the violence is ASEAN. After all, it has direct access to junta leader Min Aung Hlaing, the man most responsible for the atrocities committed by his troops. In late April, Min Aung Hlaing attended a leaders' meeting on Myanmar, held at the ASEAN Secretariat in Jakarta. After the summit, a five-point consensus was agreed, which included calls for the immediate cessation of violence. Yet Min Aung Hlaing has done nothing of the sort, and the violence under his watch has only continued since the summit. Do ASEAN leaders really want to be made a mockery of like this? Or are they going to step up and use all diplomatic powers at their disposal to demand that Min Aung Hlaing sticks to his promise to end the violence? There are a number of measures ASEAN can take to positively contribute to an improvement on the situation on the ground. Firstly, it must set a clear timeframe for Min Aung Hlaing to deliver on the points agreed at the ASEAN leaders' meeting and put in place mechanisms that hold him accountable. At the very least, it should suspend all official invitations to Myanmar until violence has ended and all political prisoners have been released. One of the points agreed at the leaders' meeting was for constructive dialogue. Any dialogue ASEAN holds with Min Aung Hlaing must be limited to only bringing an end to the violence, as well as immediately and unconditionally releasing all political prisoners. After all, genuine dialogue cannot take place while thousands of people, including political leaders, are being held in prisons on trumped-up charges. ASEAN's efforts on Myanmar must also bring into the fold members of the National Unity Government, or NUG. It should also listen to representatives of the country's ethnic armed organisations. Then there's ASEAN's collaboration with the United Nations, in particular the Security Council and the Secretary-General. The UN's experience and knowledge in dealing with conflict situations could drastically strengthen ASEAN's response, while in the face of crimes currently taking place, there is a global responsibility to find solutions and support ASEAN's efforts. ASEAN must also finalise the nomination of the Myanmar Special Envoy at the earliest opportunity, and who must immediately after their nomination engage with the NUG and ethnic armed organisations, and work towards putting in place the recommendations mentioned here and more at the earliest possibility. The stakes couldn't be higher for ASEAN, and the bloc's credibility depends on its ability to respond effectively and help prevent Myanmar from becoming a failed state with spillover into the entire ASEAN region. And ASEAN could even bring China into this process. As we discussed in the previous episode, China can have a positive role to play in Myanmar due to their size and proximity. So far, Beijing has been reluctant to criticise the Tatmadaw too heavily, but there is a potential space to change that if senior officials there were given the opportunity to look at the situation in Myanmar from a slightly different perspective. Here's Jason Tower, who we heard from the previous episode, and who is the Myanmar country director of the United States Institute for Peace.
At the moment, China sees the situation as Myanmar is essentially stable as long as the Tatmadaw are there. The minute the Tatmadaw fail, you have kind of a Syria type of situation. Of course, from the vantage point of most Western analysts, it's the exact opposite, that really the current situation you have now, where there is, you know, violence being deployed by the SAC regime in the streets on a daily basis, where you have the economy imploding, you have rising levels of transnational crime, you have self-defense forces popping up all over the country, and you have many of the EAOs fighting back against the Tatmadaw. I guess really the question is would there potentially be a way to look more deeply at the situation on the ground, perhaps by broadening some of the stakeholders that senior Chinese officials are engaging with to help them really see that a new normal isn't coming. I mean, it's not like waiting 1 or 2 months, the Tatmadaw is suddenly going to gain control over the situation. That's just not going to happen. People are very angry. They're upset. They're continuing to mobilize despite getting well over 800 deaths by the security forces. So I would think that, you know, if decision makers in China were to see that this situation is not likely ever going to lead to a new normal, that really the security situation is going to continue to deteriorate, and there's a very limited chance that China's strategic investments would move ahead without some major change in the State Administrative Council regime. I think if stakeholders were able to really kind of broaden some of Beijing's perspectives on these issues, that might help a bit.
And what about longer term measures? In recent weeks, there's been much debate regarding governments around the world recognising the NUG as the legitimate government of Myanmar. Shortly after the NUG was formed, one of its representatives said that some countries' governments were preparing to endorse them as the legitimate government, although progress in this area has until now been slow. Even if states couldn't necessarily recognise the NUG as the legitimate government of Myanmar, they could hold active negotiations with its representative in order to help boost their legitimacy and public standing and extend them with de facto recognition. Here's Jason Tower again.
Really, the National Unity Government and the CRPH, in terms of their own diplomacy thus far, they really haven't been able to get such good access yet to a lot of countries across Asia. And I think that that's maybe another place where there is an opportunity, really, maybe to start opening up some new pathways to addressing the situation. Should more states across Asia start to have higher level engagements with the National Unity Government and start building up cooperation with them, and that could well include China. I mean, if China were to start engaging them a little bit more seriously, if other states across Asia were to start engaging them a little bit more seriously, it might help them get the standing that they would then need to really look at how ASEAN could potentially consider more of a dialogue role or a potential future mediation role between various actors and country.
This would also send a clear signal to the military junta that they have not been recognised as the legitimate government of Myanmar. Other calls being made by rights groups such as APHR, as well as Tom Andrews, the UN Special Rapporteur on Myanmar, of the UN Security Council to urgently impose a comprehensive global arms embargo on the Myanmar military. Such an arms embargo could also be established outside the Security Council if countries individually join. It would bar the direct and indirect supply, sale or transfer of all weapons, munitions and other military-related equipment, including dual-use goods. It would also ban the provision of training, intelligence and other military assistance. More than 40 countries, including members of the European Union, as well as the UK, US, Australia and Canada, have bilateral arms embargoes in place against Myanmar. In contrast, according to Burma Campaign UK, at least 12 countries are involved in training and cooperation with the Myanmar military. This includes India, Thailand, Vietnam, Cambodia, Russia, China, and North Korea. And one of the key demands from the people of Myanmar, and one of the most important actions the international community can take, would be to cut off the junta's access to funds. As discussed in the first episode of the series, the Tatmadaw has built up huge economic interests, particularly through its two conglomerates, Myanmar Economic Holdings Limited, MEHL, and Myanmar Economic Corporation, MEC. As the UN fact-finding mission report found, these conglomerates have more than 100 businesses in industries including construction, mining, manufacturing and tourism. The Tatmadaw's military operations against their people are heavily supported by the business interests. An Amnesty International report published in 2020 revealed that between 1990 and 2011, MEHL paid an estimated $16 billion in dividends to military units, and these military units are committing deadly campaigns against their people. In comments to the Human Rights Council in March, Tom Andrews, the UN Special Rapporteur on Myanmar, said,
"There is growing evidence that this same Myanmar military, led by the same senior leadership, is now engaging in crimes against humanity, including the acts of murder, enforced disappearance, persecution, torture, and imprisonment in violation of fundamental rules of international law."
Wai Nin Puint Don is campaigns officer for Burma Campaign UK. Having been born in Yangon but now living abroad, she said she's proud to be from Myanmar, in part due to its vast natural resources, which over the last few decades have been plundered by the military.
It should have been a very, if not very wealthy, it should be a country with good education and healthcare system. But the military, over the decades, they have been using these natural resources for their own benefit. They buy weapons to strengthen their military, which, you know, is targeting civilians. There is no external force to fight. They are fighting ethnic civilians and they are targeting oppressing people. And they are using that money to enrich themselves rather than helping the country. When Myint Aung staged the coup, he calculated that he could get away with very little response from the international community. And he has been right so far, because although there have been some sanctions and some action against the military, not a lot has been happening. And the international response has been frustratingly slow.
Some governments around the world have taken action in terms of stifling the junta's access to funds. The United States has been one of the most proactive, placing sanctions not only on MEHL and MEC, but also on Tatmadaw business interests in the area of gems, rubies and jade, as well as the State Administrative Council. The United Kingdom and European Union have also placed sanctions on MEHL and MEC, as well as senior junta members. One country, however, that has fallen disappointingly short in this area is Australia. Canberra is still yet to place sanctions on the junta's business interests, claiming that there would be, quote, very little to any positive impact of people on the ground if sanctions were imposed. But let's be clear, this is a disingenuous response. None of the calls being made of a broad-based sanctions put in place in the past that targeted the entire economy, but instead intelligent targeted sanctions that cut off the generals' access to cash, which they are using to acquire weapons that are killing their own people on an almost daily basis. Is whining Puint on again.
What we've seen is a drip action from the international community. I think there needs to be a system put in place to identify which companies and which enterprises are owned by the military and put sanctions on them, because we need to cut the money going into the military pocket. And they care about the economy, they care about the money, and they will take the international action seriously then.
All in the international community can go much further than they currently are. A coordinated international regime of targeted financial sanctions is also required against the senior junta leaders and their associates, as well as their sources of funding. This includes military-owned enterprises, their subsidiaries, and the Myanmar Oil and Gas Enterprise, which is now controlled by the military junta. There's also a humanitarian disaster taking place in Myanmar. According to a humanitarian update provided by UN OCHA in late April, 40,000 people have been displaced in southeast Myanmar since December 2020, 11,000 in Northern Chan State since January 2021, and 5,800 in Kachin State since March 2021. In addition, at least 10,000 refugees have fled Myanmar since the coup in early February, according to UN agencies. We were unable to organise an interview with relevant agencies before recording this podcast, but the below extract is taken from a statement published by UNHCR on the 12th of May.
Words matter. The men, women and children fleeing Myanmar because violence since February 2021 are refugees. As refugees, they should be allowed access to the territory to seek asylum and be protected against refoulement, which means that they should not be returned to their country as long as it is not safe. People from Myanmar already abroad should not be returned when seeking international protection and should be referred to the appropriate authorities. Refugees have the right to return to their homes voluntarily, in safety and with dignity. While a solution to this crisis lies in Myanmar, the international community must provide protection and support to fleeing refugees. Governments are encouraged to keep their borders open and allow refugees from Myanmar safety and protection in line with long traditions of offering sanctuary to those in need. In order to respond to humanitarian needs, it will be important to provide support and adopt an inclusive approach in responding to the problems of refugees fleeing their country, including access to territory, protection from detention and abuse, and access to basic services. Humanitarian access to arriving refugees is essential to provide the necessary assistance.
With regards to humanitarian response, right groups such as APHR have also called on the ASEAN Coordinating Centre for Humanitarian Assistance on Disaster Management, or the AHA Centre, to closely collaborate with local civil society organisations, as well as relevant UN agencies, to provide aid in the country directly to those in need. Given the scale of the aid required, coupled with the military's history of blocking its delivery, such collaboration with agencies experienced in these operations will help ensure that ASEAN's intervention abides by the principle of do no harm. And finally, to the issue of international accountability. At the core of the crisis currently taking place in Myanmar is the deep-rooted culture of impunity within the Tatmadaw. Over the last few decades, thousands of people, possibly tens of thousands, possibly hundreds of thousands, have been killed by the Tatmadaw, with almost zero repercussions. For Myanmar to move forward in the future, there must be accountability for the Tatmadaw's past and current crimes. Here's Tirana Hassan, Deputy Executive Director and Chief Programmers Officer at Human Rights Watch, and someone who's long been engaged on Myanmar issues.
Essentially, what we're talking about in relation to international justice and accountability is ensuring that there's no safe haven for war criminals or people who commit some of the most serious crimes that could be committed. Ultimately, what we're trying to do is ensure that no one is able to commit those most serious crimes with impunity. And many people, I think, they would argue that criminal prosecutions for, you know, atrocity crimes might be an obstacle for peace. But actually, you know, from what I have seen in various contexts around the world, and I think that it is applicable to Myanmar, is that you really can't have peace without accountability. Or if you don't have accountability processes, then peace will be very short-lived in the future. So you know, when we're thinking about Myanmar, it's really clear that crimes have gone, you know, unchecked for a very long time. And that has simply reinforced the ability for perpetrators, and particularly the Tatmadaw, to repeat their behaviour and continue to commit some of the most serious crimes on the books.
In the context of Myanmar, she believes the international community, and in particular the Security Council, have a crucial role to play.
Really, what we're talking about is for the Security Council, for the international community, to take measures to stop what is happening. And that includes, you know, plenty of things which are within the reach of the international community if there was the sort of response and political will. And those sort of things include targeted sanctions, diplomatic non-recognition, an arms embargo, and of course a referral to the International Criminal Court. These are all within the power of the Security Council, and there's a multitude of other steps that can also be taken. But, you know, the problem is not just around does the Security Council invoke the doctrine of R2P, it's will they have the moral and political courage to take the steps that are necessary to ensure that those who are responsible for the coup and for the violations that have occurred and the crimes that have occurred since the coup and also for the violence that's occurred across Myanmar before that, will they be held to accountable? And, you know, we shouldn't talk about this being a pipe dream. It is within the grasp of the international community. It is within the control and the power of the Security Council members. And we just haven't seen that sort of moral and political courage, neither from the Security Council, and probably we haven't seen the level of action the regional actors either. I think that one of the frustrations that we have seen across the board is there's been a lot of rhetoric, there's been a lot of political and diplomatic statements around calling for, you know, for violence to be curbed and making pleas with the Tatmadaw. The reality is that the Tatmadaw are actually committing these crimes, and you know, we really need to see real action at this point. And so that involves, you know, an arms embargo. That involves ensuring that those, we can even take action about those that have arms embargoes in place already, and ensuring that there's, you know, more strengthening, monitoring and enforcement of the prohibition of arms exports, and as well as increased scrutiny on intermediaries like brokers and shell companies. But we need to stop with the political ping pong, you know, of saying whose responsibility is this. It's what we know is that action needs to be taken, and that action needs to be taken right now, and it needs to come in the forms of targeted economic sanctions and travel bans and asset freezes on the Myanmar military and on the military businesses. And we need to ensure that, you know, the subsidiary companies and the directors and officers of these conglomerates and entities, that there is action taken on them. That is the only way we are going to start seeing any sort of curbing of the actions, and for the military and its leadership to actually start feeling the consequences.
It's abundantly clear that any future for a democratic Myanmar must be one that is without the Tatmadaw, or at least a military that is free from civilian oversight. It's clear from the protests and underground movement that continue across the country that the people will not accept anything less. The international community must help the Myanmar people with these efforts. They must listen to their demands they are making and work alongside them. As discussed at the start of the episode, this will require determination, resilience, commitment, as well as cooperation from a range of different actors.
Friends, the organizations and UN and the governments and the international community, use all of your means to stop the violence in Myanmar, because our Myanmar people work with democracy, work with freedom. We don't want to go back to our dark era, so please stand with us. Don't shut your mouth. And speak up, speak out for us. because we know that we believe that we will win. The truth shall prevail.
We need international community to stand up. We need action. We don't need words anymore. We don't need statements anymore. We need actions desperately. My people are in desperate situation. And now, millions of people join this protest against this evil regimes of military. They don't want to live under the military regime again. They don't want to live under this killer, this attacker, this terrorizing of every day to their life. So this all, we all, 54 million people saw, we have no future with military regime. Our future is with democracy. Our future is with Federal Democratic Union of Myanmar. Our future is where we get justice. Our future is where we get the freedom. So we are asking international community, particularly our ASEAN leaderships, to please help us restore democracy, freedom, and justice.
Well, for anyone who's tuning in from Myanmar, my thoughts are with you, my support is with you, and we will see better days.
This series of Myanmar, Anatomy of a Coup, was written and produced by me, Oliver Slow, with editorial input from Elise T.A. Dagousset. Thanks also to Fiona Servais. Thank you also to everyone who agreed to be interviewed for the series, and all the listeners who followed along. We hope you found it useful. For those who'd like to support the pro-democracy movement in Myanmar, you can contribute by visiting isupportmyanmar.com, and you can also donate to independent media outlets such as Frontier Myanmar and Myanmar Now. Links to these pages can be found in the show notes. APHR's work is supported by the Swedish International Development Cooperation Agency, or SIDA, the Norwegian Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and the Open Societies Foundation. This series is part of APHR's podcast channel, Advocate, which addresses some of the most important human rights developments in Southeast Asia. Please listen, share, subscribe, and if you like what you've heard, review wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information about APHR's work, please visit our website, aseanmp.org. Thanks for listening.